Well, if you've been tracking along with us for the last 5-6 weeks, we've been doing a study that I'm calling, in the broad scope of things, God's Economics. And the last two messages were particularly a overview, survey of the Bible and what it says about giving. And I brought it in for a landing, those two parts, last Sunday, by bringing us into the New Testament, the New Covenant, to see what the teachers in the New Covenant, especially Jesus and his apostles, had to say about our giving to God. And one of the things I've been trying to emphasize is that this, for us as Americans, is probably as central of an issue to our spiritual lives as it is probably comparatively to any other place in the world, simply because God has prospered us fabulously. Now, as I was talking last week, of course, I finished up by introducing just initially the concept of grace giving. And I'd like to camp on that this morning. I'd like to dig a little bit more deeply into what that's about, how that works. What does that look like? How does it affect us? And what should be our attitudes as we engage in this process that God has called us to? We want to look at the calling, and then we want to look at five guiding principles from particularly 1 Corinthians 16 and then also 2 Corinthians 8 and 9, five guiding principles to help us as we engage in this spiritual activity. Okay, so I want to begin by talking a little bit of history of the Apostle Paul and give you sort of a historical frame of reference out of which the passages that we'll be plowing with, where they come from. Now, Paul's third missionary journey lasted from 53 to 57 A.D., about 4 years, over 3 3/4 years. And during this journey, he spent about 2.5 years of this time in the great city of Ephesus. He really opened that place up, and he had a great ministry there. Toward the end of his residence in Ephesus, messengers had come across the sea from Greece, particularly from the city of Corinth, to inform him that things in the church at Corinth weren't so healthy. The messengers reported that there were divisions in the congregation and other kinds of serious problems, and the letter described problems associated with immorality, problems in the marriages in the church, problems associated with the practices of Christian liberty that were getting out of control, problems with public worship. And Paul responded to these questions and concerns in a letter that we know as 1 Corinthians. But in the midst of this letter that particularly talks about problems, there was a bright spot. Now, there were several bright spots, actually, but the one that I want to point to had to do with the fact that Paul was informed that the Corinthians were very enthusiastic about a proposal that had been made that the churches in Europe, particularly Greece, would gather a collection, a relief collection, for the church in Judea, especially in Jerusalem. And apparently, they jumped on that idea, and they said, oh, this is great. We're all in on that idea. Count us in. In fact, we want to lead the way. We want to be the chief leaders and givers in this project. And so their enthusiastic response led Paul to end this letter of 1 Corinthians, to end it by commenting to them, giving them some initial instructions on how to go about leading the way in this great gracious gift for the brothers and sisters in Judea. And he introduces this instruction in 1 Corinthians chapter 16, verses 1 and 2. And he said this: "Now about the collection for God's people, do what I told the Galatian churches to do." Right there, you're informed that this was a pretty wide-ranging plan. Verse 2, "On the first day of every week, each one of you should set aside a sum of money in keeping with his income, saving it up so that when I come, no collections will have to be made." Now, I'm looking at a passage that some might argue, but that's not exactly about week in and week out giving for the church. I'm perfectly aware of that, and I understand. But I think by connection with meeting a need in the early church, there are still principles embedded in what Paul does and says here concerning this particular gift that do give us wisdom and principles for regular giving as well as extraordinary or extracurricular giving. Now, beyond what he wrote to them in this first letter, 1 Corinthians 16, approximately 6 months later after writing this letter, Paul had left Ephesus, and he was making his way north to go across the Bosphorus into northern Greece. Actually, it would have been going westward, and then down into Macedonia, where he would have gone to churches like Philippi and Thessalonica and Berea, visiting them on his way to Corinth. And in his journey in Macedonia somewhere, he decided he needed to write another letter. And part of that letter contained further instructions about the Corinthians' preparation of this benevolence gift. Now, it's clear from what Paul says in 1 Corinthians or 2 Corinthians 8 and 9 that there were reasons for these instructions. Things had developed in a very interesting way. Apparently, the Macedonian Christians, the northern Greek Christians, had heard what the Corinthians had said they were going to do. And that really inspired them. That charged them up. And they said, "Can we get in on this deal?" In fact, Paul says they insisted on being able to participate in this great benevolent offering. And this was in spite of what Paul describes as deep poverty. So they got juiced up about this opportunity in spite of being in conditions of deep poverty. Well, Paul's making his move heading south from Macedonia toward Greece, towards Corinth in the southern isthmus where Achaia. And some Macedonian brothers wanted to go with him down to Corinth. And I'm thinking what they're saying is, "Man, we want to see what the Corinthians are putting together. I mean, that sounds so exciting. Those brothers have really inspired us. We want to be in. We want to see the fruit of their preparations." And Paul is going, "Oh boy." So he writes to the Corinthians and he says to them, "You guys better be getting things ready, because we're coming. And it's not just me. It's the brothers from Macedonia. And I don't want you Corinthians looking bad. So let's get it ready before I get there." And near the beginning of these instructions in the second letter, as he's giving them instructions on being ready, he makes a very interesting comment. You see this in 2 Corinthians chapter 8, verse 7. He says to them, "I want you Corinthians to excel in the grace of giving. I want you to excel in this grace of giving." You see that in 2 Corinthians 8, 7. "But just as you excel in everything, in faith, in speech, in knowledge, in complete earnestness in your love for us, see that you also excel in this grace of giving. And right there, what you see is, in the mind of the Apostle Paul, there is, with the act of giving, clearly, some aspect of grace. Not just grace that we do, but grace that we receive from God. And I want you to be very careful to get that. There is a marvelous grace associated that comes from God as we are participating in this activity called giving. God wants his people to excel in this spiritual practice of grace giving. Now, from the instructions in 1 Corinthians 16 and here in 2 Corinthians 8 and 9, I see embedded five guideline principles. And I think there are more, but these are the ones that I want to emphasize this morning. And I want to work through them principle by principle, because I think they are there to motivate us in this exercise of giving from which God pours out grace. So the first one that I want to examine appears in 2 Corinthians chapter 8 in the first five verses. And I'm calling this guideline of grace giving, giving devotedly. Giving devotedly. Giving, grace giving is an act of worship. I think that's the point that Paul makes in these first five verses. Let's look at these. 2 Corinthians 8, verse 1. Now, brothers, we want you to know about the grace that God has given the Macedonian churches. Out of their most severe trial, their overflowing joy and their extreme poverty welled up in rich generosity. I mean, right there. That's just fabulous. Out of the most severe trial, their overflowing joy. That sounds contradictory, doesn't it, to us? Severe trial, overflowing joy. Wow. There's got to be something really special there. Their extreme poverty welled up in rich generosity. For I testify that they gave as much as they were able and even beyond their ability. Even beyond their ability. Sacrifice. Sacrifice. Entirely on their own, they urgently pleaded with us for the privilege of sharing in this service to the saints. And they did not do as we expected, but they gave themselves first to the Lord and then to us in keeping with God's will. So all of this is the fruit of them having given themselves to the Lord first. Now, what this dedication, this giving themselves to the Lord consisted in, Paul doesn't specifically state it, lay it out, or explain it. But I don't think it takes a whole lot of deep reflection to conclude that it was probably motivated by a spirit of compassion. You know, when you're in hard times like they were, it's probably not too difficult to identify with other people who are in hard times, like the Judeans, the brothers over in Judea. And so it wasn't difficult for them to be struck with a sense of compassion for their brothers and sisters suffering. And I suspect that Paul, as he was teaching and ministering in the early days of these churches, that he had explained to them what had happened 23 years earlier in Jerusalem, when, after Jesus had risen from the dead, the thousands of pilgrims who had come for Passover, the thousands of Jewish pilgrims from all around the known world at that time, a large number of them, we know when we go through Acts chapter 1 through 6, we can count up somewhere at least 8,000, heard the gospel being preached by Peter and the apostles in the temple and all through the city of Jerusalem, and they were responding to the gospel and receiving Jesus as their Messiah. And then based on that, the change that comes with receiving Jesus as your Messiah, the change of heart, they hung around the city. And they were wanting more instruction. They wanted to know more about this new faith. They weren't leaving. Well, that's a lot of souls to keep in houses and to keep fed. Well, God was at work. The local Christians sacrificed to provide for them, provide food and shelter. And we read last time about how a number of the gracious and wealthy believers at that time were selling their property and bringing the cash in to help buy the food, take care of the pilgrims who were hanging out in Jerusalem. And that went on for over 7 weeks until Pentecost came. And then the Spirit came. And man, things really blew open. So now 23 years later, many of these sacrificial supporters of the first Christian revival, guess what? They're still enduring poverty. So the Christians in Macedonia, sensitive to the example that had been set for them, at least reported by Paul, they committed themselves to the grace of God and they said, you know what? We owe them our eternal lives for what they did for us. And this meant seeking the courage to put together financial gifts in spite of their extreme poverty. And no doubt this commitment included the acknowledgement, you know, hey, all that we have spiritually is a gift from God. Hey, what we have materially doesn't even compare to that. So they just said, God, look, this is all yours. We want to be involved in this deal. So give us the courage, give us the help, give us the faith, because we want to move forward. That's what I'm talking about, devotedly. And I think that's what Paul means. They gave themselves to the Lord. They laid it out in front of the Lord and they said, look, here we are. I mean, we want to be in this. We really don't have much, if anything, left. But we are thankful to you, God, for what they did, and we want to help them. So they cast themselves upon God's faithfulness, and they gave devotedly. And I think this is the attitude God is looking for in the way we give, an attitude of devotion to Him. You know what, God? Look, it's all yours. I'm just so thankful that I have the privilege of the abundance that you have given me. I don't deserve it, but I have it. Help me to be generous and gracious and thankful in the way I use it. Guideline number two. Giving should be done purposefully. I see this in a statement in 2 Corinthians chapter 9 and verse 7. Paul makes a statement there. Each man should give what he has decided in his heart to give. Some translations say what he has purposed in his heart to give. Whether it's decided or purposed, the principle means that giving should be planned. Shouldn't be something that's haphazard. Should be thought through, thought about, prayed about. It should be purposeful, intentional. And in fact, the instructions we read from Paul in 1 Corinthians 16:2 actually add to that notion of purposefulness, intentionality, thoughtfulness, because he said back in that verse, on the first day of every week, each one of you should set aside a sum of money in keeping with his income. That means planning. That took some thought in advance. To set aside something on a regular basis, that's why I say purposeful. Grace giving is purposeful. And for the Corinthians who were craftsmen or who were merchants and they received compensation for their wares or their services or whatever they did on a regular basis, well, on a weekly basis, they were putting stuff aside. And for those who were farmers and their crops would come in maybe on a seasonal basis for them, when the crops came in, they would take the portion that they had purposed to give and they would bring that, or money for it to the leaders of their church. The principle is that we should set aside our offerings to the Lord in a purposeful manner. That means that you need to be thinking about it and praying about it. It means that when you come here on Sunday morning, your giving can't be according to the whim of the moment or the emotion of the moment, but you should know what you're going to give before you even get here. That's what we're talking about. Planned, thoughtful, purposeful giving. Our church uses a budget. We have all together through the leadership and the ministries, we have designed how we operate financially on the basis of a budget, and that's developed based on the history of what we've been given in past years and what are our goals for what we'd like to accomplish as a congregation. But you see, there's a plan that we're working off of. And as leadership, we're accountable to follow that plan. And we have a review that's done every year. And that review by our accountant is available for anyone to see. So it's all out in the light of day. And I think in the same way the church operates, God is calling all of us on an individual or family basis to operate the same way. Thoughtfully, purposefully, according to planning. Now, you may recall that when we were doing a survey of giving in the Old Covenant, in the Old Testament, that there were a number of places where we saw that Moses had prescribed that the children of Israel were to give a tithe, and of that tithe was supposed to come from what was described as the first fruits. I don't know if you remember that designation that was associated with all of the farm produce that was to be given, the first fruits. And when it comes to the herds and the flocks, it was supposed to be the firstborn of your herds and your flocks were supposed to be part of that which was given to the Lord. And this sort of sets up a pattern that is called first fruits giving. And sometimes this is thought of in the discussion of grace giving as the idea of giving off the top. Giving off the top as opposed to giving off the bottom. Let me see if I can explain what I'm saying. Repeatedly, as I said, you will see Moses talking about them, the Israelites, giving the first of what comes in. This is a principle of faith. This means that when you're harvesting your grain, you take the amount of the first things that come in and up to the amount that you know is a tenth, you take that in to the Levites. Now, you have no idea if there's going to be a crop failure following that initial harvest, but you take your tenth in. Anyhow, you're trusting God to provide for you out of what's still left to be harvested in the fields. Now today, I think a lot of Christians struggle with giving because they're giving off the bottom. What I'm saying is they're giving out of what's left over at the end of the month, at the end of the paycheck. Let me see if I can give you some illustrations of what this giving off the bottom might look like. Some scenarios, okay? See if you identify with any of these examples. Scenario number one. Bill and Don are in their mid-30s. Bill has steady work as a salesman, but there always seems to be too much month left at the end of their money. Bill and Donna sincerely intend to put into the offering box whatever is left at the end of the month, but between house payments, car payments, TV cable, internet, cell phones, bowling league, vacation bills, and bills for other things, and occasionally sticking a little bit into savings, there just never seems to be anything left at the end of the month. They feel bad. But what can you do when you're out of money? They say. Well, let's think about that. Problem. Bill and Donna struggle with the typical problem of people who give God what's left over, who give God off the bottom. First of all, There's no planning involved in how they give. Second, they have no way to see God build their faith and contentment because they don't trust God with their needs. If they determine to give to God at the beginning of the month, then the rest of the month would require them to practice discipline in how they spent what is left. They might actually realize after a while that they really didn't need some things, and they might actually notice how putting God first made them more satisfied and aware of the fact that God was providing for what they really needed. Bill and Donna will never experience God's grace in their finances until they start to give purposefully. And the procedure that would really jumpstart that would be for them to start giving off the top instead of off the bottom. Scenario number two. Joan is a 22-year-old in her last year of college. Her 30-hour-a-week job pays just over minimum wage, and she takes home about $1,000 a month. Joan's parents still provide room and board, but she has to take care of her tuition, books, and other expenses. About giving, Joan says, "I can't afford to give. I'm barely making it now. If I tried to give 10%, that would be $100 a month, and I'd probably have to drop out of school. I'd like to give, but I just can't." Now, having college students of my own, I'm listening. I'm trying to identify. But here's the problem. Here's Joan's problem. Joan thinks that she can't give 10%, so she might as well give nothing. She will never grow in her giving out of that attitude. Joan is also making a key misjudgment that a lot of Christian people make. Now, hang with me on this. This is an interesting statement. She thinks that finishing her academic education is more important than her development of Christian character. Did you hear that? Finishing her college education is a higher priority than developing her Christian character. Oh, I see that a lot in all ages. Developing so many other aspects of our children's lives, but not concentrating on the development of their Christian character. By Joan's logic, she will be better off finishing college without Christ first in her life. Now, some might say, "Oh, Dean, you're overreacting to this." I don't think so. So, and also, she is exaggerating the situation, like a lot of Christians who are defensive about giving. Listen how she's exaggerating the situation. Even if she had to drop into part-time status as a student, it would only delay her graduation by one semester. But she says, "I just have to drop out totally." No, that's an overreaction. And if she was giving during all that time, she would have the joy of Christ being her focus in school, and she would be learning to trust Jesus with her future financial decisions right away, before she gets into the real world. And besides all that, it is possible that God might actually honor her sacrifice by providing for her $100 shortage. Maybe with a raise at her job. Wouldn't that be exciting? Problem is, Joan isn't even looking for that. Isn't that sad? That's what happens when Christ isn't the focus in your finances. You never see the possibility that God might provide above and beyond what you can think or ask. Situation three. Bob is in his early 50s. His wife Elaine says, Bob is in his early 50s. Early. His wife Elaine says, not Crane, not Hess. "For years, we frittered away our income on all kinds of luxuries. Now we're 12 years from retirement and we don't have anything saved. On top of all that, we still have two kids in college that need our help." We'd like to give to the church, Bob explains, but Scripture says we've got to provide for our family first. After we get our kids through school and maybe get a nest egg started, then we'll start giving. Problem. Bob and Elaine are dishonoring God, withholding their wealth from God in order to compensate for their poor planning and self-indulgence for over 25 years. Their first obligation is not to their children's college education, but to the honor of God and their own repentance. Actually, Bob and Elaine have no true appreciation for God's provision in their lives. If they did, they would be humbly confessing the sins of their years of selfish indulgence and luxuries. They would be mourning all the lost opportunities to invest in eternal treasures. They would be actively pursuing ways to offload wasteful luxuries that they have accumulated and find ways to reduce the cost of their lifestyle. They would take the opportunity now to have candid conversations with their two kids about the poor example they set of stewardship of God's provisions over the last 25 years. They would explain to their kids that they need to put God first in their financial affairs, and if that means everyone will have to trust God about the funding and the pace of college education, what a much better frame of reference for going through college. With respect to retirement, what Bob and Elaine need more than a retirement fund is a revival of genuine trust in God. But apart from the practice of sacrificial giving, they will never discover the real security that there is in God. They'll never really experience that God is their source of security, not a retirement fund. And they will never discover that security, that security of God, until they step out and start putting their spiritual growth ahead of all their financial concerns. The most powerful strategy they could employ to start seeing and trusting in God's grace would be to purposefully plan to start giving 10% off the top. It might feel radical and jarring, but the effect on their spiritual life would be transforming. Might also rescue their kids from the entitlement view of life that usually comes when parents haven't set any example of restraint or sacrifice in their financial affairs. And folks, that entitlement mentality is all over the landscape of American culture. So when you give off the top of what God blesses you with, it does make you struggle to pay the TV bill, the internet, the cell phone, the cable, the Sears charge, yada, yada, yada. But you know what? That's a righteous struggle. Because you've already taken care of God. And rather than resenting God for having to give, you rejoice knowing that your confidence in Him is growing and that you are seeing steadily glimpses of His faithfulness and that you can really rest in what He does to provide for your needs. Giving purposefully. Well, the third guiding principle I see in 2 Corinthians 8, verses 11 and 12. That is, that giving should be done proportionately. Grace giving is done in proportion to what God provides. 2 Corinthians 8, 11 and 12 read this way. Well, actually, I'm going to read verse 10 as well. And here is my advice about what is best for you in this matter. Last year, you were the first not only to give, but also to have the desire to do so. Now finish the work so that your eager willingness to do it may be matched by your completion of it. Now get this. How? According to your means. According to your means. For if the willingness is there, the gift is acceptable. According to according to what one has, not according to what he does not have. So Paul's saying, we're not talking about making pledges of funds that there's no reasonable expectation for you to have that. Now, if somebody wants to step out and take a risk and trust God for more than they can see, that's not dishonoring to God. But what he's talking about here is proportionality. And 1 Corinthians 16:2 makes the same point. On the first day of every week, each one of you should set aside a sum of money in keeping with his income. He's basically saying, you know what generally comes in. And it's based on that. This is some magic trip. This is taking a common sense assessment of what your resources are. And then saying, God, I want to be generous with this. I want to trust you that as I give what I think I can handle, that you'll take care of the rest. And you'll really show me what my needs are. Giving proportionally. Now, the principle of proportional giving is that the giver has established a percentage. Proportionality, that's what it means. You kind of identify a percentage that you want to work with. Increased income will be accompanied by increased amount of giving. It's all percentage. Likewise, decreased income may be accompanied by decreased giving. Let me give you a couple of examples. You take a single mother with a disabled child who's receiving no child support. Maybe she sets a goal of 1% or 2% to give. Well, that sounds like the rich. That sounds like the poor widow who put in the 2 copper coins, and Jesus said she gave more than anyone. You know, to bust on someone like that and say, well, you need to be up here at this 10% or whatever. I mean, it's not proportional to her resources. Now, you take, on the other hand, people with good health and steady incomes in our affluent society. Less than 10% is probably an expression of the fact that they don't really appreciate that all that they have is from God and that he is providing abundantly. And they probably have an underdeveloped faith, and they may even have a lack of real grasp of the fact that the church doesn't run on air. The Church of Jesus Christ, which is the backbone of their stability socially and spiritually, also depends on the gifts of its people. And then for believers with 6-figure incomes or more, giving only 10% is probably a sign of a serious misunderstanding of where this prosperity comes from and what God's point is in seeing that you have it. So I'm talking about relational and giving out of in proportionality. Someone might ask, well, how do I know what percentage to give? Nobody can tell you that. That really is between you and God. And that was the force of what I was trying to say last week. That's a spiritual issue. There are no percentages enforced in the new covenant. I think it really depends on how much you want to grow in your faith, though. Because for us in an affluent culture, we have to accept the fact that money really is a central issue in our day in and day out lives. And it does affect or afflict our faith and how we manage what we have. I think it's also a matter of what kind of relationship do you want to have with God? I think there is a tighter kind of relationship with God when we are focusing on trusting him, because we are generously giving what he has entrusted us with. But bottom line is, folks, I think when it comes to percentage, you're probably on target when there's a little bit of a, when there's a feeling of sacrifice there. When there's a sense that because I gave this, I can't do all the things that I would like to do. That's just an idea. I think you're starting to hone in on where God would want you to be when there's a little bit of sacrifice connected with your chosen proportion. Fourth guiding principle, giving should be done cheerfully. 2 Corinthians 9, verses 1 to 7. It's a little bit longer passage. Gives a little bit of the feeling, background of this instruction Paul is giving to the Corinthians. 2 Corinthians 9, verse 1. There's no need for me to write to you about this service to the saints, for I know your eagerness to help. And I've been boasting about it to the Macedonians, telling them that since last year, you and Achaia were ready to give, and your enthusiasm has stirred up most of them to action. So there you see, you know, Paul's been telling the Macedonians that, you know, the brothers down in the south in Corinth, they're all in on this. Verse 3, but I am sending the brothers in order that our boasting about you in this matter should not prove hollow, but you may be ready as I said you would be. For if any Macedonians come with me and find you unprepared, we, not to say anything about you, would be ashamed of having been so confident. Now, Paul knows human nature. Yeah. Talk is cheap. That's what Paul knows. He's saying, don't shame yourselves. Verse 5, so I thought it necessary to urge the brothers to visit you in advance and finish the arrangements for the generous gift you had promised. Then it will be ready as a generous gift, not as one grudgingly given. What's he saying? Well, he doesn't want to arrive in Corinth and say, hey, boys, we ready? And them saying, okay, oh, man, we got to scramble. Oh, boy, oh, what a burden this is. And it all turns into kind of a grudging thing. Paul says, no, don't let it boil down into that. Get ready. Verse 7, each man should give what he has decided in his heart to give, not reluctantly or under compulsion, for God loves a cheerful giver. God doesn't bless people who give grudgingly or because of someone's pressure on them to give. God knows whether our hearts are right. We're not fooling God. And sometimes our hearts are stingy because we feel, I had to work so hard for that. And now I got to give it to God. Oh, beloved. Pray that God would release you from that if you experience that. And sometimes we're begrudging giving generously because we don't think other people are giving their fair share. Oh, pray that God will release you from that. It's not about what other people are doing. This is between you and God. Don't begrudge or become grudging because of what other people are doing. If they come to you and they say, hey, I need help because I struggle with stinginess. Well, you know, get into it. Mix it up with them and talk to them about what may be the issue for them. But don't let what they give hang you up. All these reasons betray a lack of gratitude to God for his grace and his provisions in our lives. You know, giving should be worship. I think that's what Paul's talking about, too. I mean, when you think about worship, we see throughout the New Testament, worship should be a rejoicing in God. You know, an adoration of who he is and how magnificent he is. What a magnificent creator, all powerful, all knowing, knows the deepest secrets in our lives and our hearts, and is thinking about us all the time, the psalmist says. And he has everything under control. He's a sovereign God. Nothing escapes his notice. And worship is bringing our gifts with a cheerful attitude. That's worship. It's rejoicing and the privilege that we have to invest in what God's doing with his program. And if you've been cheap and grudging in your giving for a long time, you probably need some financial counsel. You may need to get to know someone who has found grace giving to be something that's just a part of the way they live. They can talk to you, talk you through it, and help you. It's better to put away the shame and get this thing worked on. Maybe you need to just read a good book. There are some good books I can recommend for you. Or maybe you do need a financial counselor who can help you get on a budget and get yourself out of debt and have a hard look at some of the things that you think are necessities that really aren't. In our materialistic atmosphere and in the culture we live in, there are things that are considered necessities that are far from that when it comes to the reality of what our real needs are. You know, ministry may be supported or funded by gifts that are given grudgingly. But when that happens, something is lost. There is a real aspect of enthusiasm in the ministry's life that is stripped out when the money comes in, but it comes in grudgingly. The people who are doing that, there's no heart, there's no engagement, there's no enthusiasm, there's no faith in that. And so, you know, the ministry is well funded, but there's no energy. It's symptomatic that maybe it's being given grudgingly without cheerfulness. Well, here's the last one. A fifth guiding principle for grace giving. It should be done generously. And the principle behind generosity is seen in 2 Corinthians chapter 9, verse 6. And it's that principle of sowing and reaping. You know, we know it as, you know, what goes around comes around, right? Or it's the investment principle. You only get out of something what you're willing to put into it. The same principle here. It's the principle of sowing and reaping. 2 Corinthians 9, 6. Remember this. Whoever sows sparingly will also reap sparingly. And whoever sows generously will also reap generously. There is an element of stepping out in faith and sowing generously. You can never be sure if God's going to turn around and fill out all the list of things that you want, you like, and you wish to do. But you can be sure of this when you're giving generously. God can replace money with joy. And God can replace things with a deeper affection for him. And God can provide stuff with a more profound sense of security in this life, in God. And God can give you freedom from the demands of all the stuff that always needs to be maintained and painted and taken care of and insured and watched over and protected with fences and all that. Freedom from that. And ultimately, he can replace any kind of money that you might give with satisfaction of knowing that your earthly generosity's, it's being banked permanently up there. And when you get home, it's going to be waiting for you. But until you give generously, you can't experience reaping generously. And like I've been saying for several weeks, living in an affluent society like we do, it's going to either choke the joy out of your spirituality, or it's going to be for you an opportunity to make a lot of spiritual investments where you can be passing on a lot of joy, a lot of grace, and have an awful lot left over when you arrive home. Our son Steve, who's out in California, we've been going back and forth on whether he's going to get home for Christmas. And, you know, he's a graduate student. Graduate seminary students usually don't have two nickels to rub together. And he's gotten pretty good at the two-meal-a-day routine. And he's not complaining. He's just having a ball. Going to class, learning stuff. Just, you know, it's like, oh, man, feed me with a fire hose. So, you know, hey, you coming home for Christmas? Well, the only time I can get off is during the high season when the airline tickets are like, you know, twice what they usually are. So, no, I think I'll be hanging out here in California, okay. But in his small group, he just happened to share it. And the other day, one of his buddies said to him, yo. So he gave him a check for half the flight home for Christmas. I mean, this guy, he doesn't have that much money, but he was thrilled. You know, Steve has this glorious smile. And when it cracks open, you know, this guy was like, it was worth it all just to see that. That's what happens with people who are engaged in generous giving. It just, you know, the joy just goes around and comes back. Well, there you have it. Five guiding principles for grace giving. Give devotedly, casting yourself on God's faithfulness when you give. Give purposefully, plan your giving, and be systematic about it. Give off the top, not off the bottom. Give proportionally. That is in proportion to what God provides for you. Give cheerfully. Let your giving become a way that God can lift your heart out of all this materialistic soup that we live in. Have the joy of sharing his provisions and give generously. And take a risk in your giving. Put yourself in a position of material sacrifice and see how God replaces stuff with real spiritual satisfaction. Okay? Let's pray together. God, I know for me, I'm learning a lot. I'm feeling a lot of conviction from what your word says. I'm having to think about where I thought I was comfortable and wondering if you're really saying not where I want you to be, buddy. I want you to see more of me. I want you to experience more of my grace. I want your faith to grow. So God, as a pastor teacher, I pray that you'll help me to continue to grow in this department of my spiritual walk. Thank you for the privilege of living in an abundant, affluent culture like we do. Thank you that it offers us wonderful opportunities to be engaged in your business. And your business is eternal redemption. And what could be more fabulous than seeing that what we do now lasts forever? So God, we pray that as we're learning a little bit more about how you think about these things, that we would rejoice and be grateful for the privilege of participating in this grace of giving. And we ask this in Jesus' name.